Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for December 11th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a newly discovered complete skeleton of a dinosaur, the hurdles remaining for solar thermochemical fuels, and strategies for mitigating flooding, the most damaging natural disaster. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about testosterone's bad reputation from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
There were three main groups of dinosaurs by the time of the late Triassic epoch, some 230 million years ago. Sauropomorpha, large-legged, long-necked, four-legged plant-eating dinosaurs. Ornithischia, also plant-eating dinosaurs having bird-like hip structures. And Theropoda, bipedal dinosaurs that tended to be carnivores but with more lizard-like hip structures, which gave rise to today's birds. But the fossil record is generally lacking when it comes to these early dinosaurs, particularly fossils of dinosaurs that represent the basic dinosaur forms. Many dinosaurs of this time period are known from just a few fragments. But now, in a paper in this week's Science, Sterling Nesbitt and colleagues describe several nearly complete skeletons of a late Triassic meat-eating theropod, which they've named Tawahale. I spoke with Nesbitt from Austin, where he works at the University of Texas.
Well, we're introducing Tawahale, a new carnivorous dinosaur from the late Triassic of North America. Tawa is very important to our understanding of early dinosaur evolution, number one, because it's so complete, and number two, it tells us a little bit more about more fragmentary forms at the base of Dinosauria. Tawa shows us that in the early evolution of Dinosauria, there are multiple lineages in South America that are dispersing to North America. So the theropod fauna, the carnivorous dinosaur fauna in North America during the late Triassic, is composed of elements that have come from South America independently. Pangaea was formed at this time, so you could walk from pretty much the South Pole to the North Pole at this time. And this brings us to a larger point Tawa just hints at, and that's you can't characterize the early evolution of dinosaurs from one site and say it's happening all over the world.
Even though there's Pangaea.
Exactly. So Tawa's living in a low latitude in the tropics, and the origin of dinosaurs probably happened in South America at this time, which was at a high latitude. So dinosaurs are distributing non-evenly.
Finding their niches, as it were.
Yeah, we don't know exactly why, but this is the pattern that we see right now.
What did this dinosaur look like? You said it was carnivorous. How did it move? Do we know?
Tawahale was bipedal. We can tell this from its proportions of its hind limbs to its forelimbs. It had somewhat of a long neck and a long counterbalancing tail. The skull was elongated and looked a little bit more like Coelophysis, kind of a long tube-like snout with long jaws and lots of recurved sharp teeth. Because the teeth were recurved and kind of like a steak knife, we know that this animal ate meat.
Now, you said this was a new species. What set it apart from other dinosaurs of the late Triassic?
Tawa has an interesting combination of different characters, so different characteristics that we see only in Tawa. It's a combination of these characters that we can say, oh, Tawa is different from Coelophysis or Herrerasaurus. So there isn't a huge number of unique characters of Tawa except for tiny little anatomical details, but in combination, these characters show that Tawa is brand new.
Now, I understand that the dinosaurs of this period are separated quite a bit by their different pelvis, either a lizard-like pelvis or a bird-like pelvis. Which one did this one have?
Tawa has what we call a saurischian pelvis or lizard-like pelvis, which is funny because the bird relatives, the carnivorous dinosaurs, originally had the lizard-like pelvis, but evolved the bird-like pelvis later in their evolutionary history.
Did this dinosaur have any hollow bones like we see with other dinosaurs of this period?
The bones of Tawahale have very hollow interiors. These bones were very hollow, just like a bird bone today. The outer cortex of these bones were very thin, and the inside was basically hollow.
So is it fair to say that this dinosaur was evolutionarily, anyway, changing from more like a lizard-like dinosaur to a more bird-like dinosaur?
That's a little difficult to say because a lot of the early sauropodomorphs and ornithischian dinosaurs, relatives of Triceratops, also were more bird-like than lizard-like. So it's a little difficult to say that Tawa tells us anything about that. But Tawa looks more like a typical carnivorous dinosaur than sauropodomorphs or ornithischians.
What about the fossils themselves? When was this set of fossils found?
The original bits of Tawa were actually found in 2004 during an initial excavation in northern New Mexico. These bones were then brought to the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting, where a couple of colleagues and I looked at them, and right away we knew this specimen, which at the time consisted only of a couple limb bones, like the upper thigh bone and some vertebrae, were unique among late Triassic dinosaurs. In 2006, we received a grant from the National Geographic Society, made a large excavation in the area in which these bones came from. And right away, we started finding partial skeletons of Tawa. And what's really neat about Tawa is that most dinosaurs that are known from the late Triassic are only known from like a hind limb or just bits of the skeleton. Tawa, on the other hand, is known from 5 to 7 individuals, and we have bits of the skeleton of different skeletons from throughout this area. So it's very well known, and it's very rare to have known this much about a single dinosaur during the early time of dinosaur evolution.
Are there sister-like species that have been found elsewhere? Which dinosaurs would it be most closely related to?
Well, Tawa is an early representative of the theropod lineage, the lineage in which birds and T-Rex are part of. Tawa shows that some more controversial forms from South America, such as Herrerasaurus and Eoraptor, are also part of that group.
The Eoraptor being one of the early smaller dinosaurs, right? Only about a meter long, but still a carnivore.
Yeah, Eoraptor, it looks like, is also a theropod dinosaur based on its similarities with Tawa.
And Herrerasaurus, sort of a larger version of Tawa. Is that right?
Herrerasaurus right now is our most primitive example of the theropod lineage. It shares features with Tawa, and this is one of the things Tawa shows us, is that the features in the skull of Tawa have a combination of Herrerasaurus-like features, such as a big upper jawbone, and coelophysis-like pictures, something that's a true theropod character. And this is something like a elongated snout with an elongated premaxilla, the front bone in the upper jaw.
Is it sort of at the stage where, you know, we've got this one well described, we want to find other examples elsewhere, or are you going to go back to this particular site in New Mexico and keep digging, or what's the next step?
We will continue to work at the Hayden Quarry for years because it's producing hundreds of specimens a week. It's one of the most extensive bone beds that I've ever worked in. And there's a mix of early dinosaur things. There's a mix of crocodilian relatives, and some of these specimens are a very rare and new taxa. So we're going to continue to go back to the Hayden Quarry for years to come. Now, we're always looking for new localities in the late Triassic that contain dinosaur fossils because they're very rare in North America. We're always looking for new localities that produce skulls and complete skeletons of dinosaurs, but there are only half a dozen of these sites that have ever been found in North America.
Sterling Nesbitt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sterling Nesbitt of the University of Texas at Austin is lead author of a paper describing Tawahale, a late Triassic dinosaur. and the insights scientists are gaining into the early evolution of dinosaurs from the nearly complete skeletons. Now, Science's Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel joins us with a policy update about the United Nations Climate Summit in Copenhagen.
Although a great deal of pessimism has been expressed lately about the climate negotiations that have just begun in Copenhagen, there are some signs of recent progress internationally. Just before the December 7 start to the negotiations, China and India announced plans to reduce their energy intensity below 2005 levels by 45% and 25%, respectively, by the end of the next decade. Energy intensity is a ratio of the amount of carbon dioxide emitted per unit of economic output. The White House has announced that consensus is building for the Copenhagen talks to include a commitment from developed countries to provide $10 billion annually by 2012 to help developing nations combat climate change, and that the United States would pay its fair share of that investment. 9 Senate Democrats, including several seen as swing votes in the climate debate, sent a December 3rd letter to the president containing 10 principles that should be embodied in new international agreements and in domestic legislation. The list includes reducing emissions in developing nations, protecting U.S. trade, helping poor nations adapt to climate change, and coupling technology cooperation with strong protections for intellectual property rights. Another announcement that could have significant effects on U.S. climate policy came from Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson, who announced the agency's finding that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions endanger the public's health and welfare. This announcement allows the agency to proceed with rulemaking to address climate change and is in response to the 2007 U.S. Supreme Court decision that greenhouse gases fit within the definition of air pollutants as written in the Clean Air Act.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. As oil prices have gone up or down, so too has interest and funding for converting energy directly from the sun. Researchers from all over the world have been trying different approaches, from photovoltaics to thermogenerators. And now, as Science's Bob Service reports in this week's issue, a group of scientists are working on a new class of solar chemical reactors that aim to make liquid fuels from air, water, and sunshine.
This article is about a group of researchers that are looking to run the combustion of fossil fuels in reverse. So instead of burning fossil fuels and taking energy out in order to drive a car or something like that, they're doing the opposite. So they're starting with the end products of combustion, which is things like CO2, and they're pumping sunlight into them in a reactor that generates a lot of heat, and that heat is then used to reform chemical bonds, ultimately with the goal reforming liquid hydrocarbons that can then be used anywhere gasoline and hydrocarbons are used now.
Any technical hurdles still to overcome with this technology, or does it work well now and is safe?
So this technology does work now, and there are a number of groups around the world that have demonstrated that they can get this process to work and work pretty efficiently, actually. But when you're talking about making synthetic gasoline or any energy commodity, you're basically going up against the juggernaut of fossil fuel. So you've got to be able to make it very cheaply, and you have to be able to make lots of it. And so it doesn't really do very much good if you can only make it for $100 a gallon equivalent of gasoline, and you can only make, 10 liters a day or something like that, because that's just not going to give you enough. So in terms of the technical hurdles, what they're doing now is they're trying to do a lot of catalyst development to try to find catalysts that do this process more efficiently and faster.
And before we go further along this path, how efficient are these reactors at converting sunlight to chemical energy? And what percentage, what efficiency would it take to make them competitive?
So the process right now is about 3% efficient in converting heat that comes from the sunlight into chemical energy. In order to be, very successful, there's a lot of factors that go into this, but what the folks in the community believe, they need to reach probably about a 20% efficiency. And even though that sounds like a big jump to go from 3% to 20%, folks in the community think that that's a pretty doable process, but it will take a lot of materials development and engineering work to get there.
Now, in particular, you mentioned catalysts before. What's involved with the catalysts? How is the technology working?
Yeah, let me explain that. So what these processes do, or what these systems do, is they split molecules like water or carbon dioxide. And to do this, they require a two-step process. And for this process, they use specially designed catalysts. And I can give you an example of one that works with iron oxide, which we know is rust, basically. And so the catalyst starts in the first step, where you pump in a lot of heat, as much as 1,500 degrees Celsius, into this chamber that has the catalyst in it. And the catalyst will then, at that high temperature, will spit out oxygen. They'll lose oxygen. And the oxygen is vented to the outside, and it becomes the oxygen we breathe. The catalyst is then moved to a second reaction chamber where it is exposed to water or CO2, and it just plucks oxygens off those molecules. So it splits those molecules, basically, and creates either carbon monoxide or hydrogen gas, depending on what the feedstock is. And then that reforms the catalyst to what it uses in the first step, and so then it just goes around in a cycle again and again and again. And that's an example that uses this iron oxide, but there are many other catalysts that do this as well, and that's going to be a major focus for the future of this field, is to explore new catalytic systems that do this very quickly and efficiently and without breaking down over time.
Now, you mentioned some of the economic challenges that lie ahead for this technology. Do researchers have any concerns about scaling it up like they do with biofuels, for example?
Right. That's actually one of the things that people see as the biggest advantages for this technology, and that's because it's typical with any technology that harvests sunlight to make a fuel, like biofuels, or in the case of photovoltaics that are making electricity. Most systems like that are actually quite inefficient at how much of the solar spectrum, how much sunlight they can grab. And just to take one step back, that's why for biofuels, for example, you have to grow, you know, millions upon millions of acres or hectares of cropland in order to grow enough corn or enough sugarcane or what have you in order to generate enough fuel that's going to be useful for a large segment of your population. So because this process consolidates or concentrates sunlight, it uses the entire solar spectrum. It doesn't throw anything out, but it just converts it all into heat. And then it uses all of that heat to drive a chemical reactor, and in this case, to promote chemical reactions that are pretty well known. So the upshot of that is it actually scales very well. You could think about using on the order of hundreds of square kilometers or something like that of land in the desert southwest, for example, that has a lot of sunshine for a lot of the year. And that would get you a long way to producing all the fuels you would need for your country on the order of 10 or 20%. And that's pretty impressive because for biofuels, for example, it takes much more land than that.
Lately, there's been talk on cap and trade and other forms of carbon tax. What level of tax on carbon emissions would it take to make these solar thermochemical fuels economical, or is that a realistic scenario even?
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't actually address that question. I didn't really research the question of the exact tax that would be needed. But it's clear that if you're trying to compete directly with fossil fuels that are just coming out of the ground, that this process will be making fuels that would be more expensive. So it's not going to be able to compete dollar for dollar without some sort of a carbon tax or cap and trade. I think what the research community here is taking as a given is that as the world community moves forward, some sort of tax or cap and trade is going to come into place with needs to limit and cut carbon dioxide. And they assume then that that's going to cause the price of oil and gasoline to go up, and that would make this process more cost competitive. Right now, the community, without having put a huge amount of work into this, think that they can make gasoline for about $10 or less a gallon. And that does sound expensive, but they are confident also that the prices will likely come down because much of the technology that they are relying on, things like solar concentrators that capture sunlight and reflect it onto, in this case, a chemical reactor, are already being used for solar thermal systems that generate electricity. And so these things are in the process of becoming an industrial commodity. And as that process goes along, it's expected that their prices of the infrastructure will just keep coming down. So they are banking that they will be able to piggyback on this success of solar thermal electrical systems, and that will help drive the cost down in the future of solar thermal chemical fuels.
Bob Service, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Science's Bob Service reports in this week's issue on the hurdles remaining for solar thermochemical fuels. Worldwide, the most damaging natural disaster is floods. In a policy forum in this week's Science, Jeff Opperman and colleagues advocate for what they call functional floodplains that would mitigate flood risk, increase goods and services provided by floodplains, and provide additional resiliency to potential climate change impacts. I spoke with Opperman from his office at the Nature Conservancy in Virginia.
Well, here we're defining functional floodplains somewhat broadly, but the chief underlying characteristic is that they are hydrologically connected to a river, meaning that water can move from a river during high flows or flood events and actually enter the floodplain. A floodplain is a feature that is defined by that happening. So when we're calling it a functional floodplain, we're really referring to the fact that a lot of floodplains have become disconnected from the river. So there's no longer the ability for high flows to move out onto the floodplain. And when we talk about restoring a functional floodplain, we mean restoring those connections.
Are there examples of functioning floodplains that you and your co-authors would like to see emulated?
Well, there is the one example that we highlight, and that's something called the Yolo Bypass, which is in the Sacramento Valley of California. And it's interesting. I think people didn't even think about it as a floodplain the way ecologists might view a floodplain until somewhat recently. It was a part of the Sacramento Valley flood control system, and it just happens to be 60,000 acres of floodplain that was reconnected in the 1930s. And it's connected in an engineered way, meaning when the river, when the Sacramento River reaches a certain volume, it flows over a weir into the floodplain. So at most flows, the Yolo Bypass is not connected to the Sacramento River. But during big floods, it begins to flow, crest over that weir, and enter the bypass. And people over recent decades began to notice, hey, this is phenomenal habitat for birds. And then in about the past 10 years, people recognized that native fish were moving from the river out in the floodplain and deriving all the benefits that native fish get from natural floodplains. It was an excellent place for fish to spawn, for juvenile fish to rear. And so people realized this engineered structure, the 60,000-acre bypass that's connected to the river for flood risk reasons, is actually working like a floodplain. And in much of the world, floodplains are providing the incredibly important ecosystem service of supporting productive fisheries. And so it's the floodplains that are often the true engines of productivity in large rivers. And we try to make the connection in this paper that there's even more benefits. There's a groundwater recharge that during droughts, that area has served as a groundwater bank. There's recreation in the form of duck hunting clubs and tour groups go there. It's a vast area of open space for a very rapidly growing region of the state of California. And then the main point we make is that it really increases the flexibility of how California's big reservoirs are managed.
Now, a good portion of the Yolo Bypass is owned privately, isn't it?
Right. That's another key thing. That in our paper, we're making the point that we're really advocating very large-scale shifts in land use. And there's simply no way, economically or politically, that this could be accomplished by turning huge areas of floodplain into parks. So what we're proposing throughout the paper is a way that this strategy can be compatible and even supportive of vibrant agricultural economy and private land ownership. And so, yes, in the Yolo Bypass, about two-thirds of the land is privately owned and in productive agriculture.
So farmers who own these lands, some of the most productive and fertile farmland, they're compensated if ever there's a flood?
My understanding is that what it is there's a flood easement. The state of California owns a flood easement, and that has been true since the lands were, I think they were owned by the state when they created the Yolo Bypass, and they sold them to private landowners in the 1930s with this flood easement. So that original sale price, of course, reflected the fact that these lands were eligible to be flooded by the state whenever they needed to for the purposes of this flood control system. I don't think they are compensated. Now, what's nice about California is that the way it's very compatible with agriculture is California has this very pronounced Mediterranean climate where there's almost no precipitation from, in a typical year, from April to November. It's really dry. And the real flooding in the bypass tends to occur from December into March, into those time periods. So in most years, there's not a conflict. I think there definitely are some years where the farmers have to wait for things to dry out before they can plant. But as far as I know, there's not things like catastrophic loss of crops, simply because the growing season and the flood season are discontinuous.
So that works pretty well for California, as you say, but how likely then is this to be a strategy that would work, say, in Iowa, where there is flooding during the growing season,
right,
or in other places internationally?
Right. So there you'd have to adjust the strategy in the exact way it's carried out. So what we describe in the article is a whole range of agricultural practices or approaches, or really a range of strategies that could be producing revenue for private landowners that would be compatible with flooding. So, for example, if there was a large-scale reconnection through levee setbacks or the creation of a bypass similar to the Yolo bypass in a place where flood risk could occur during the middle of the growing season, there would need to be a mix of strategies, a mix of land uses, and a mix of sources of revenue for private landowners. So we describe there are emerging markets for ecosystem services such as carbon sequestration and nutrient sequestration. And those are services that floodplains do provide. So with various climate change policies, there will be a price, or there already is, and there will continue to evolve a price for carbon mitigation. So that could be a source of revenue for landowners, is carbon sequestration. And a floodplain forest is perfectly compatible with occasional periodic inundation, even extended inundation of a month or two, because the trees that would be growing there would be the trees that naturally grow on floodplains, which are very flood tolerant.
In the U.S., anyway, are there federal funds available for acquiring or converting floodplains to these kinds of management systems that you're proposing?
Well, there's programs like the Wetland Reserve Program. That is, I believe, administered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And there was a recent, in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, USDA was given some funding, something like $145 million, to acquire floodplain easements, very specifically for lands that had been damaged through flooding recently. And to acquire those lands, or to put easements on those, to allow them to revert to natural habitats that would therefore not be vulnerable to flooding and wouldn't require disaster relief payments going forward. And there was a great demand for that. I think they received applications for more than 10 times the area of land than they had the funding to provide, showing that there could be a demand for these types of programs that would provide revenue to landowners to begin to transition from land uses that are vulnerable to flooding to land uses that are compatible with flooding.
Now, these are upfront costs to plan for potential disasters in areas where there's a history of flooding. Who, if anyone, is against or blocking this kind of funding, and why?
Well, one, I'm not sure if there are those programs that I mentioned. I don't think there's really people opposed to those. I mean, other than the fact that, of course, resources are always constrained, and so there's competition for resources and whether or not there's enough money available to do this. The major thrust of what we are proposing, it has been proposed by others. I mean, we're not the first people to be proposing this. There's a long history of people suggesting that there should be large-scale reconnection of floodplains to make them more resilient and more sustainable over time. And I think one of the primary obstacles to this has been the fact that agricultural areas are hesitant to see large areas of agriculture moved out of production and moved into other land uses, or to be acquired by state or federal governments or conservation organizations. Understandably, there is concern that large-scale changes in ownership will have implications for the whole community. There will be reduced purchasing of farm machinery or seeds or fertilizers, and that has ripple effects throughout the community. There will be potentially hits to the tax base. And so agricultural areas are often very hesitant to go along with proposals for major levee setbacks or realignments. And in the wake of the 1993 Mississippi floods, there was a lot of energy and enthusiasm by some entities to do what we're talking about, large-scale reconnection. But that definitely is not embraced by everybody. So understanding these very real and understandable hurdles, what we've tried to put the emphasis on and what we would like to see programs and strategies explore is this concept of how to make these lands more sustainable, more resilient to floods, and providing this whole range of services that functional floodplains can provide, but to do it in a way that is truly consistent with private land ownership and a vibrant agricultural sector. So that's the angle that we're really emphasizing here, and hoping that that would help to overcome some of the previous opposition to this type of proposal.
Jeff Opperman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Jeff Opperman from the Nature Conservancy on making sustainable floodplains through large-scale reconnection to rivers. Find the policy forum in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about testosterone's bad reputation. This is the hormone typically associated with aggressive behavior.
Well, that's what's thought, Rob. I mean, men tend to have more testosterone and men tend to be more aggressive. And so the common wisdom is that testosterone is one of these hormones that makes us more aggressive, more competitive, more self-serving, more antisocial is how researchers define the term.
So now the uncommon wisdom.
Now, the uncommon wisdom, which is argued by the group of researchers in this study, is that testosterone is really more about maintaining social hierarchy. And what they mean by that is they think it sort of has the opposite effect. It makes us play fair with each other so that we sort of maintain our social cohesion, social hierarchies, helps us know how to treat people. A side effect of that is, you know, when we're competing in our social hierarchies, we can tend to get aggressive, which would actually not be a result of testosterone. It would be something completely unrelated, but it could be why testosterone is often associated with these negative connotations. But, you know, this is a theory the researchers had. They wanted to find a way to test this, and that's what this study is all about.
So how'd they go about it?
They played an economic game with a group of young women.
Why women?
Well, women have a lower baseline level of testosterone, and the pharmacokinetics, as they say, of testosterone is actually much more well understood in women than it is in men. And so researchers sort of had a better model to work with women. So what the researchers did was they took about 60 women, and they had them play this economic game on a computer. And these women were given 10 Swiss francs, and they were told, you have a partner, and you can decide how evenly you want to split that money with your partner. If your partner likes the division that you've proposed, then you'll both get the money. But if your partner doesn't like the division that you've proposed, in other words, if she thinks you've proposed something very unfair, then neither of you get the money. And so the basic idea of the study is to test how fair these women would act. I mean, it makes sense if you're being really fair. You're going to say, well, let's split it five francs, or 50-50. That seems like a fair split, and chances are the partner player is going to agree with that, and everybody goes home happy. But if you're being very sort of aggressive or being very unfair, you might propose a very unfair split, and then both of you would lose out on the money if the partner rejects the offer. And so the researchers played this game, and the twist they added with testosterone was that some women got a dose of testosterone and some women got a placebo, and they didn't know which one they were getting. They were just given something under their tongue. And what the researchers noticed was that their theory seems to be correct. The women that were under the influence of testosterone were actually a lot more fair. Women that were on testosterone proposed giving their partner an average of about 3.9 francs, which is almost a 50-50 split, versus 3.4 francs on the women that were on placebo. So this was some nice baseline evidence that testosterone actually makes us more fair, not more antisocial. But the really interesting results came next, because the women didn't know whether they had gotten testosterone or whether they got the placebo. And so after the experiments ended, the researchers conducted a survey. They said, what do you think we gave you? Do you think we gave you testosterone, or do you think we gave you a placebo? And what was really interesting is that the women who thought they were given testosterone but were actually given a placebo were actually much more antisocial than the women who thought that they were given a placebo but were actually given testosterone.
So they were the most unfair when they thought they had gotten testosterone.
Exactly. And what that says to the researchers is that all of our negative associations with testosterone, that it makes us antisocial and more aggressive and less fair, actually has a very profound impact on how we behave. If we think we're on testosterone, we're going to behave like society says we should behave if we're on testosterone. But that's not actually what testosterone is doing. If you look at the data, what testosterone is doing is almost the opposite. It's making us more fair and more social.
Keeping the status, as it were, status quo.
Exactly.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, this is another story that has to do with the sexes, but not the sexes in humans, but the sexes in flies. This is a story about how female flies can be too attractive for their species.
How so?
Well, let's start with what makes an attractive fly. It turns out that the bigger the female, the more attractive she is. And the thinking goes is because bigger females have more resources for her offspring and actually even more room for eggs. And so if a male really wants to increase the number of offspring it has, it's going to go for these bigger females. And that's actually what researchers see. If they put, you know, a bunch of males in a vial with females of various sizes, the males tend to congregate mostly around these bigger females. But, you know, the males are very disruptive when they congregate around females. They perform these mating dances where they're flying around and buzzing their wings. You can actually see a video of this on the site. And they generally just really harass the female, so much so that she actually has a hard time eating because she's surrounded by so many males. And the researcher said, that can't be good for the females. I wonder what the effect of all this male harassment is. And what they did was they looked at how many eggs these large females lay when they're harassed by males versus when they're not harassed by males. And they found that the females lay significantly fewer eggs when they're harassed by males than when they're left alone.
Do the bigger females still lay more eggs than the smaller females on average?
They do. And so that's the real conundrum here, because on the one hand, females can be too attractive for their species. And what's meant by that is if females are so big and that's causing a lot of males to congregate around them, and the females are laying less eggs as a result, and these eggs, which ostensibly for genetic reasons, become larger females in the long run, then the long-run effect of this male behavior is that it's causing fewer large females to be born, and that's going to be bad for the species in the long run because these bigger females lay more eggs and have more resources. But from the male's perspective, it still makes sense. You know, the males really aren't thinking about the species. They're thinking about themselves.
Assuming they're even thinking at all, right?
Well, assuming they're thinking, it's how much a fruit fly thinks. But what they're, you know, from their perspective, they're still going to get more offspring from these larger females because even when harassed, these larger females lay about 4 more eggs on average than smaller females. So it's still to the male's advantage to go after these big females, even though from the species perspective, it may not be a good idea.
So in a sense, with this behavior, the males are selecting against a trait that's beneficial for their species.
Yeah, and it shows that evolution doesn't always lead to something that's better for the species. At least that's what one expert says.
Does it make a difference that these were all captive flies? I mean, does this kind of crowding behavior of females happen when they're not all trapped together?
Well, that's a good question, Rob, and one I don't know the answer to.
Okay. So last story then. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, we started at humans. We went to flies. Let's end up on monkeys. This last story is all about how monkeys might be using a form of human grammar.
Nouns, verb, adjectives, adverbs, what?
Well, we're talking about suffixes. Researchers in this study found that monkeys seem to add an extra sound, and it's always the same sound, to the end of some of their common calls to change the meaning of the calls, just like we might add a couple extra letters to the end of a word to change the meaning of a word.
What's an example?
Well, let's take a couple. First, listen to this call. Now, that's a call monkeys use to warn their comrades that an eagle is approaching. Now, listen to this call.
It's sort of like the first one, but yeah, I hear the suffix, there's ooh sound.
Exactly. There's this ooh sound at the end. Now let's try a different call. Listen to this call. Now that's a warning. These monkeys, and these are what are called Campbell's monkeys. They have these actually almost like old man faces and a tuft of orange on the top of their head. You can see a picture of them with the story. So that's a call these monkeys use when a leopard is approaching. So a different warning call for a different predator. Now listen to this call.
Again, the ooh.
Again, the ooh. And so what the team found is they found a number of calls like this where there was one call that they knew the monkeys used for something, but then they heard that call again in a different context with this ooh sound in it. And they made a bunch of recordings. They followed these monkeys around, and they discovered for that first call we heard, the hawk call, which is by itself is for eagles. When the monkeys add the ooh to the end of it, it became this sort of general alert for a disturbance somewhere in the tree canopy, you know, maybe a branch falling or something like that. And with that second call, we heard the so-called crack call, which is for leopards. When an ooh is added to the end of that, that could be almost any disturbance. So any kind of something that happens in the forest, monkeys might use that crack oo call.
Does the oo sound mean anything by itself? Like, don't take this as seriously?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, if this is really sort of a suffix, as researchers are proposing, then this oo sound, you know, should be sort of consistent. It should mean something. It should sort of maybe always change these words in the same way. And it doesn't exactly seem like that's happening. It seems like it's a nice way for the monkeys, instead of having to invent a brand new call, just to modify some of their other calls to really increase what the researchers call their vocal repertoire. You know, these monkeys live in these dense forests. They often can't see each other. And so they really have to have a lot of different calls for a number of different situations. You know, and rather than inventing 10 calls, why not just take 5 calls and add this suffix to them to change the call? But it's really still, the jury's really still out about whether the monkeys are actually using this as sort of a grammar suffix the way we do, or whether it's just sort of an interesting sound they found that if they add to the end of their call, it changes the meaning of the call. And to really find that out, the researchers are going to have to do a lot more studies with this to figure out not only how monkeys make these calls, but how other monkeys respond to these calls. And that's really going to also determine how these oo sounds are really being used.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about blocking fear memories in humans and also a story about why dogs are such good sniffers, why their sense of smell is so much superior to that of humans. And for Science Insider, the science policy blog, we're following the Copenhagen climate talks that are occurring for the next couple of weeks, and we've got daily coverage about that meeting in addition to all of the other policy stories we're running. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the December 11th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Trederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.